WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Dr. Oliver Sacks is a neurologist who describes himself as a reporter of the human condition in extremis. His patients have severe neurological disorders such as aphasia, Parkinson's disease, and Tourette's syndrome, disorders which have deprived them of memory, movement, cognition, or sensation. Dr. Sacks' case studies of his patients penetrate to the moral, spiritual, and psychological dilemmas brought on by these disorders. Much of his work has been done with patients who live in the back wards of charity hospitals and asylums, people whom the medical profession had given up on. In the late 60s, Sacks began his work with victims of sleeping sickness who gave the appearance of living statues. He awakened them from that state by administering the then-new drug L-DOPA. His 1973 book about this work, Awakenings, was recently published in a new edition. Sacks' latest book, the bestseller The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, was adapted into an opera of the same name by the British composer Michael Nyman. On July 14th, it received its New York premiere. I spoke with Oliver Sacks last summer when the American Music Theater Festival presented the American premiere. Sacks told me about the patient in the title story. He was a music teacher and singer who didn't recognize that he had a disorder. These were some of his symptoms.
Well, the first problem was that he had difficulty recognizing his students at the music academy. As soon as they spoke, he recognized them at once, but he couldn't recognize them visually. And soon he couldn't recognize anyone or anything visually. He couldn't recognize his wife, he couldn't recognize himself, he couldn't recognize common objects. He saw them perfectly clearly, but what he saw carried no meaning for him and no sense. And this prompted him to sort of ingenious but sometimes wild and sometimes absurd guesses as to what he might be seeing.
And you titled the case study The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat because in reaching for his hat, he reached for his wife's head by mistake.
When I saw him in the first interview, he was obviously not demented, but a delightful, intelligent, civilized man with a sense of humor. He kept encountering the fact that he made mistakes, but he didn't recognize what the problem was. And it mixed with all his intactness. There was a succession of absurd mistakes. At one point, he confused his left foot with his shoe, and he didn't seem to know which was which. And then right at the end, when he went to reach for his hat, he got his wife's head instead.
What is the condition that he had?
Well, this is called a visual agnosia. And what happens is that the normal meeting between visual input, between images and a person's memories and ideas and feelings and expectations doesn't occur. And so, and this always goes, this goes with a problem in the visual association areas at the back of the brain. And so he sort of had raw vision, a sort of raw seeing, which didn't ascend into the realm of meaning.
Although he couldn't make sense of what he saw, he was a musician and singer, and he still had perfect musical sense. And your prescription to him was music. Why?
He was really absolutely lost in this meaningless, shattered visual world. And he desperately needed some way of organizing himself. Now, I think all of us tend to either use internal speech or internal music to organize ourselves to some extent. I mean, one has things like nursery rhymes, One, Two, Buckle My Shoe, or marching songs or work songs. But the song, as a unit of organization, became tremendously important and crucial for this man, who was so totally lost visually, couldn't use any visual organization, but in fact was a marvelous musician and singer, and a man who sort of generated songs all the while. And one saw again and again that he couldn't dress, he couldn't shave, he couldn't eat, unless he really set the activity to music internally. On one occasion when he was eating, there was an interruption, there was a sudden, the postman suddenly knocked at the door, and this This completely shattered the activity, and he looked quite bewildered for a few seconds until he was able to recapture the melody of eating.
You know, your prescription of music reminds me of something that your friend, the poet W.H. Auden, had said to you, which is that he spoke of the poetic and religious states of affliction. And I wonder what you think, how that applies to your work, the poetic and religious states of affliction.
I thought you were going to actually quote one of Auden's favourite quotations from Novalis, where Novalis says, every disease is a musical problem, and every cure is a musical solution. And certainly with Dr. P, as with many of my Parkinsonian patients, or people sometimes who can't move unless they sing or dance. You know, one sees absolutely they've been unmusicked by disease and can be re-musicked back into health. I think that the poetic and the religious are almost sometimes an integral part of patients' perceptions as to what may be happening with them. Something I describe in the Hat book and also at more length in an earlier book, A Leg to Stand On, as a patient whom I saw as a student who had apparently lost his left leg. He was found on the floor, very bewildered. He'd apparently thrown himself out of bed in a peculiar way. And the story he gave was that he had woken up from sleep. He had found that there was a foreign leg in the bed with him. Disgusting object. He threw it out. And then, and now horribly, he had come out with it, and now it was attached to him. And I said, But it's your leg? And he said, you know, shouldn't I know my own leg? And I said, yes, you should. And he said, well, I know it's not my leg. Now, this thing for him was not only was terribly wrong. It felt ugly. It felt hateful. It felt obscene. It felt unholy. It felt an offence against nature. The particular physiology in his case was that he had a tumour in the opposite side of the brain, which had expanded while he slept, and had blotted out the part of the brain which represents the leg. So the leg image had been obliterated. Therefore, he could not recognise his leg as his own. Therefore, it seemed absolutely other. But the absolutely other always seems uncanny and horrible and obscene and unholy and God-forsaken. And words like this or concepts like this will be used by every patient, irrespective of background, of intelligence, of education. The alienation is almost intrinsically in the area of subjectivity is sort of felt as anti-poetic, anti-religious. And by the same token, when it comes back, there's the feeling, to quote Dante, of the holy and glorious flesh restored. And so I think even at this level, sort of the body in health is always felt as sort of as beautiful and holy, although one may not appreciate this unless it's taken away and one suddenly deals with a radically depreciated world.
Your way of writing case studies is really very literary. It's not empirical. It's not cut and dry. You're really describing states of mind as well as neurological conditions. And I've wondered if patients talk to you that way, or if they are as descriptive as you are in telling their stories.
I think, obviously, this will depend on the condition and the patients. But above all, I think on the situation, in that if a patient is not permitted implicitly or explicitly to talk about himself, if he's reduced, if he's given a sort of catechism, do you have this, do you have that, then he will reduce himself to a list of symptoms. He won't say what is actually like. He won't depict the world he is in, which he's been thrust into. But I think that if patients have a complaint, sometimes more serious or as serious as their primary complaint is that they can't communicate what it's like. And I think that a major act of the Doctor is somehow to, De Quincey once talked about the pressure of the incommunicable upon the heart, is to let the patient try and communicate, and the Doctor must sort of help him, must reach out to delicately to assist this trembling communication. And so that between them, the way it is, the world of illness is can come into being.
You've done a lot of your work on backwards of hospitals, charity hospitals, asylums. Why have you gone there looking for the kinds of cases you are interested in studying?
Well, it was really not quite in that order. I was there.
Uh-huh.
In places which most of my colleagues wouldn't be seen dead in, and which no ambitious young doctor would go to, and which are felt to be the sticks. But in fact, here there is the, you know, there's the priceless gift of leisure. There's no pressure to diagnose, there's no pressure to do anything. Also, you can encounter a complete world. I mean, these places are really little worlds. And I think that an unpressed exploration of getting deeper and deeper is possible in such places. It's hardly possible in any other places.
There's no pressure because they're considered hopeless anyways?
Partly. This, incidentally, was well realized by the founders of neurology, by Hewlings Jackson and Charcot in the last century. They spent much of their lives in chronic hospitals, institutions, asylums. But now doctors don't. But certainly with the patients I describe in Awakenings, these people who had been in hospital for 40 years or more since the great sleeping sickness epidemic, I had no idea that such patients existed, that such lives existed, until I went into a chronic hospital.
Has that happened other times, too, that you've found disorders that have not really been described before?
Well, certainly they haven't been described with the richness and the fullness which they should have. In general, I think description has become sort of obsolete.
You've described it as almost a 19th century
yes.
art in medicine.
Yeah. I love 19th century medicine and science. It may have been so short in a way on certain empirical remedies and even relatively short on physiological concepts, and of course very short on technology, but the respect for the patient and for the detail of what was happening to them, I think, you know, could often generate almost novelistically rich and at the same time sort of medically and scientifically accurate descriptions. So much so now that there's major discoveries have been made by going back over 19th century descriptions. Now we can see what went on. I think most of the descriptions now are so meagre, so threadbare, you know, and also so they're too quick to diagnose, to pin labels on.
When you're working with patients who have been almost abandoned by the medical profession, it's just a kind of caretaking type of thing, are you able to do anything to really change their condition, or are you more interested in observing them? And let's leave out the sleeping sickness patients, because you were able to administer a new drug there that totally changed their condition. But in other cases where there isn't a drug that's going to change their state, what can you do?
There's a sort of doubleness between, the investigator and the physician, and sometimes they can go beautifully together. Sometimes they can sort of interfere with each other. But my first notion is to try and understand, with the patient what's going on. I recently retitled my first book, Understanding Migraine. It's not treating migraine, it's understanding it. Now, from the understanding, treatment may come. So that, for example, with one case I describe in the Hat Book, as I call it for short, as a Parkinsonian man who leant grossly to one side, although he wasn't aware of this. He was surprised that people commented. I took a videotape of this, I played it back to him. And it was only when he saw this that he realized what was happening. And he then asked a very acute question. He said he wondered whether there were balancing mechanisms. He used to be a carpenter, like spirit levels, like bubble levels, in the head, which had been impaired by his disease. And I said, yeah, exactly. And he then thought again, and he wondered if one couldn't make such little levels outside the head, for example, attached to by a nose clip to the glasses, and whether this would serve to balance him. And I said, oh, it's a wonderful idea, let's try it. And in fact, it worked beautifully. Now, here is a man who, all I did, in a sense, was to...
Give him a metaphor.
yes, I, did, right? Or he gave himself a metaphor. No, I assisted his understanding and indeed his movement to a cure. I mean, I love this sort of collaboration when it's possible.
I want to talk with you about some of the current work that you're doing. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, whose books of case studies include Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks is my guest. Now, lately, some of the work you've been doing is in communities. Instead of looking at individuals with disorders, you're looking at communities that have a high level of disorders within them.
I've just actually come back from Canada where I saw, I was in a village, a Mennonite community in northern Alberta, where a third of the people have a thing called Tourette's syndrome, with sudden convulsive movements and exclamations. I've seen individuals with Tourette's, and I've written about them, but I've never sort of seen a community which had to grapple with this.
It seems very inexplicable to me that there'd be a community that.
Well, here there's in this community, there's a genetic basis, and with intermarriage, it's become commoner. I'm reminded somewhat of on Martha's Vineyard, there was a hereditary deafness for more than two centuries, and the rest of the community responded by learning sign. And in fact, sign became native to everyone, and it became oddly difficult sometimes to find out about the deafness. A woman called Nora Ellen Gross wrote a very beautiful book about this and described how in interviews she would say, was so-and-so deaf? And so-and-so might be remembered as a good friend or a fisherman, a joker, a prankster, a scholar. But was he deaf? Come to think of it, people would say, come to think of it, he was deaf, except one never thought of it. You know, he was just the same as everybody else. Up in this place in Canada, partly people are not seen as having Tourette's. They say, sure, you know, grandmother twitched a bit and made faces and noises, but that's only natural. But in here, one moves into a sort of clinical anthropology as to what the whole community is like, what it is like to have Tourette's in Le Crete, what it is like to be deaf in Martha's Vineyard or some of the other places in the world where there are many deaf people, and how disease is conditioned by culture and community and vice versa.
Do people see their diseases differently when there's people around them who share it?
Very much so. I mean, one is not singled out and one is not set apart in the same way. And it, to some extent, it almost becomes, as it were, our, you know, the way we are, or else it ceases to be seen as a disease. And which was very clearly the case in Martha's Vineyard, where in fact the deaf were as able as everyone else, and on the whole better educated than anyone else. They all went to the American asylum, and the lawyers and others on the, you know, were all deaf.
I'm interested in how you developed the sense of empathy that I think it's clear you feel with the patients who you work with.
I think I was very slow to do it. My own approach was through the natural sciences. I was first had a passion for physics and later biology and later physiology. I only sort of got to individuals relatively late, you know. I don't really, but I think that if one listens, I think one has to restrict the urge to do something straight away. You may indeed need to do something, but you've somehow got to listen first, and then you will be given predicaments. you're presented with human predicaments and stories of how it is. And I don't know, these are heartbreaking, these are funny, they're absurd, they're tragic. They're often all of these at once. I think some neurological predicaments are both dreadful and funny. And again, patients may often have an extraordinary sense of humorous detachment. Some of this comes in with Dr. P and the man who mistook his wife for a hat. Something really awful is being described, but it's also funny in a way.
Sure, it has elements of slapstick.
Sure. And Dr. P knew this. I mean, one talks about spoonerisms. You know, spoonerisms were invented, if you want, by an elderly academic at Oxford, Dr. Spooner, who had a stroke, became aphasic, and tended to confuse words and say thud and blunder instead of blood and thunder. But he then, in a sense, exploited his own condition humorously and made an art of his disability.
You know, some people wouldn't allow themselves to admit to the humor in a situation like that because it would be perceived as laughing at someone who had a problem.
Well, here, of course, it's not laughing at them. It is bringing humor as one can bring poetry to the way one is.
You, the way I understand it, had a migraine problem when you were younger.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if that helped you be sensitive to the kinds of problems you've encountered as a doctor.
I think among my earliest, some of my earliest experiences, there was a family thing, was when I was about three or so, there would be visual migraines in which the appearances of objects would change and perhaps half of them would disappear, or sometimes they would appear unrecognizable. And when I came later to write my migraine book, perhaps a rather larger portion than one might expect deals with visual disturbances. And I think this, again, leads right on to the story of Dr. P's agnosia and, say, a patient I'm seeing at the moment, a gifted painter who suddenly lost all colour vision and sees in black and white. But I'm very, very fascinated by perceptual change. And I think I, as you suggest, I was probably sort of sensitised to this. When I was very young, I was forced to realize that vision, the world isn't just given to one in its form and color and movement and meaning, but in some sense it has to be constructed, and the eyes and the brain have to work right, otherwise one is in trouble. And another thing which struck me very much as a child was how if one closes one eye, the world immediately becomes flat.
Yes, yes.
Flat as a pancake. For some reason, I have very sharp stereoscopic vision and feel slightly disabled if I close one eye. But although I'm sort of... So I could never ignore the effects of the nervous system and of one's physical being. And at the same time, I always want to know the resonance as a physical being in being a person and perceiving and thinking and feeling and acting the way one does.
Well, I've always found that it's easier to see the larger things about the human condition in someone else's illness than it is about your own.
Yeah.
And when I'm in pain, I'm just thinking about the pain and not about the larger implications of it. I wonder if you're able to see the larger meaning when you have a problem, as you can see it when you're studying a patient who has a problem.
I don't know. The somewhat confessional book I wrote, A Leg to Stand On, is about being a patient with an alienated leg and trying to communicate this and failing and feeling sort of rather hopeless, and then a sort of horror about this, which I couldn't communicate. And then the magic, the absolute wonder when it came back, and the way in which the gratitude and the delight, the incredulity, the convalescent. And I'm both sorry and glad that I had that experience, but I sort of try to explore it. But it was difficult, and that book obsessed and obstructed me for 10 years. I found it infinitely easier to write about other people.
You find all these implications about the arts in the work that you do, and several artists have been inspired by your work to do plays or operas based on it. There's an opera based on The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. There's a Harold Pinter play inspired by Awakenings. What has it been like for you to see your case studies transformed into art?
First and last, it's very strange. It's rather startling and in a way wonderful to have one's own experiences and one's former patients brought to life again, so that I will suddenly see Dr. P again in the Hat opera. And seeing my patients come alive in the play of Awakenings, in writing, it seems to me that in a sense I convert patients, people, and events into words, and now they're being converted back.
Oh, back into people.
back into people. Back into events, and one can, as a writer, you can only say things on stage. You can show it specifically with Dr. P. One can show him being organized by music. You could only show this, in a sense, on stage and with music.
We only have just literally a couple of seconds left, but one of the people who's meant a lot to you in your life, A.R. Luria, who was a neuropsychologist, talked about combining the empirical and the romantic, or the classical and romantic, mm-hmm. in his work. Do you feel that's what you've been striving to do also? I haven't left you any time to answer this.
Absolutely. When I once asked Luria what he saw as his central enterprise, he said he couldn't say it in one word, but he had to use two, and he said romantic science. And I would say, hopefully, exactly the same of myself.
I thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Oliver Sacks is a neurologist and the author of the bestseller The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. The opera of the same name, based on his book, just opened the Sirius Fun Festival at Lincoln Center in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.